Good day, good people, and welcome to the Poolproof Wisdom podcast, Conversations. I met today's guest, Dave Peacock, when I worked at Anheuser-Busch, a company that I will always consider the very best company I've ever worked for, and a place where I learned the most and enjoyed the best series of professional roles I've ever known. My time there was proof that we can all enjoy success while doing work that is significant. Now, Dave impressed me because he was major. I mean, he was a respected executive and business leader at a company whose name I heard the moment I walked in the door. It wasn't lost on me either that while he did hold an MBA, his undergraduate degree was in journalism with a focus on advertising. He valued narrative, and as I got to know him better over the years, he consistently exhibited how to lead with an appreciation of both the ability to use his left and right brain. After holding many senior roles at Anheuser-Busch, vice president roles, leading the company's high-end brand portfolio, business operations, and marketing and development, he was named president of Anheuser-Busch's U.S. business unit. This was after the company was acquired by InBev and led the company during a tumultuous and yet redefining time in the company's history. After departing the company, he focused on civic engagement, including bids to keep the St. Louis Rams in St. Louis, organizing a group to secure a Major League Soccer franchise for the city, serving on the St. Louis Urban League's Restoring Hope campaign. As co-chairman of the City Arch River campaign, chairman of the St. Louis chapter of the American Red Cross, and literally dozens of other initiatives intended to make St. Louis a better city. While doing this work, he also continued to focus on business, serving on the board of directors for Stifel Corporation and as chairman of Vitaligent, the largest franchisee of Jamba Juice in California, Missouri, and Kansas. He's also an investor and a member of the board of director for Renoco Coffee. In 2017, Dave joined Schnucks Markets Incorporated, a St. Louis-based family-owned grocery store operator and pharmacy retailer with 112 stores in four states and nearly 15,000 employees. As president and chief operating officer, he also serves on its board of directors. Now, it was because of his business acumen and what I know of him as a human being, which includes an interest in asking tough questions and writing inequities, that I asked to speak with him today about a hot topic for all businesses: diversity, equity, and inclusion. If you follow Dave on LinkedIn, where he frequently addresses a variety of issues, including this one, you'll appreciate that he has clear positions on such key issues and is not at all uncomfortable with expressing them. I've got to say, I'm very much looking forward to this conversation. I can feel it in my bones that it's going to be a good one. Good afternoon, Dave, and welcome to the Poolproof Wisdom Podcast. So glad to have you here. It's been a while for us, hasn't it?
It's been some years, I know.
You look good. You look good.
You look great. You have an age. You look like exactly how I remember you, and it's been like 10 years.
It's the fat cells. It keeps things plump. I don't get wrinkles that way, so thank you. I appreciate that. The reason that I wanted to talk with you, Dave, is I was, as you know, following you on LinkedIn. I see all the things that you're engaged in. And the other day you had mentioned on a post that were about there were two Black women now in the Fortune 500. And you said that it was, quote, I love that you said, while it's great, it's 2 out of 500. If it were proportional to the adult population that is Black and female, there would be 34. More work to do. Then you hashtagged inclusion and diversity and women-owned business. And I thought, classic Dave Peacock. Insightful. You had your data correct, but it was also driven with a passion. But what made you comment on that particular post and why?
I think just because if you think about it, there is a lot of work to do. And I think the things we celebrate are in some respects too small, and we're not making enough progress, or at least we're not acknowledging that, 2 to 34 is a very, very long way. So it wasn't an impugning the person who I think sent that or the author or anything else. It's just reinforcing that, look, that's great. But the fact that we're celebrating being, you know, 7% along the way to proportional is very indicting and convicting, if you ask me.
Mm-hmm. Now, our love of symbolism, I think, carries across a lot of different industries. But what you're speaking of right now is exactly that. I mean, not just industry, socially, for that matter. We love to celebrate what looks like a win without really digging into the muck of all of it. So as we're looking at this from the perspective of, okay, so now we've got this, how do we set about defining more clearly what it is that is sufficient outside of the numbers, that is?
And I think that's the question, right? I mean, inclusion and belonging is kind of subjective. It's not something that can just be measured with data and numbers. And I think we all want to jump to the data, but it's funny. I always say, you know it when you see it or feel it. I do think numbers matter, because if you go into organizations where, call it the top 50 executives, and there's one or two people of color, they are the other. They are, regardless of how inclusive an organization tries to be, they do not feel they belong. And I recognize that. And no, what's the number? I don't know. But I think when the number is better and the roles and positions are high enough, and you truly could talk to those folks and say, yeah, I feel like everybody else. I feel I belong here. You know, I have my differences, but I'm accepted and more than accepted, I belong. That's the subjective piece that's difficult to get to, but needs to be kind of driven by conversation and discussion. Open, hard conversation and discussion.
Mm-hmm. And when you're talking about the hard conversations, how do you go about deciding how to introduce it? Now, here's the fact. Let's, you know, face it and do what my mama called calling a thing a thing. A lot of times people believe that the conversations can only be had by certain people who perhaps look more like me, right? So how right. do you bring that up so that it can be understood that you do have something to say and you do have insights to share that are important, so that even in the discussion of diversity, equity, and inclusion, it's not excluding you simply because of the person that you are and the way that you look? How do you bring that up?
Well, and I think that's important. That's a great point, because to me, if it is truly diversity and equity and inclusion, it's about privileged majority to marginalized minority. And it's not or, but both, right? Mm-hmm. And so, and recognizing along a spectrum, everybody has a different lived experience. So, you know, I have one where kind of lower middle class, grew up in St. Louis, public school kid, was one of the first classes to have desegregation. So we had a combination of North Webster Groves and Rock Hill, and you know, kids from the city bussed in, and that framed my perspective. You know, it was like 28% of my graduating class was people of color. So does that make me better, worse, expert? Not, no, just that's my lived experience. And that's as relevant as someone who, you know, goes to a generally all white, you know, private school, but has a different lived experience as it relates to interacting with people of color. And I think it's all the way to kids who grow up and go to what I'll call underserved schools and kind of live that reality. And so I think it's really understand to get into stories. You know, journalism is, even though I'm in business, journalism is really about storytelling and curiosity. And I think if you go into a discussion about diversity and inclusion that's both curious and focused on stories and understanding people's experience, I think you can end up in a better place. And I found that even in our company, I work in a grocery firm, we've been better about having those discussions and really learning what people go through, right? And once you understand, or at least can relate, even if you can't fully feel it, I think that's when you can start building bridges and just making people feel like, hey, I, even though I have this completely different background or experience, my experience is accepted, because there's a recognition that everybody's lived experience is important.
Right. That part about that lived experience, I think, is important for all the reasons you say. And I certainly do live into it. I mean, I, you know, grew up in St. Louis, North City. You know, I always tell people, I think I said this to you before, I said, we weren't poor, we were po. Couldn't afford that extra O and R to be poor. So all Black schools, everybody in my neighborhood looked like me. When I was about to go to college, my high school counselor wanted me to go to her alma mater, Fisk University. And I said something that was probably not welcomed nor atypical of me, however. And I told her, I said, Mrs. Richardson, I said, I've seen enough Black people. I need to see somebody else, because I had no experience with anyone outside of people I saw on television, right? And though I only went down the street from Vashon High School to St. Louis University, it was an entirely different world. Had I not had that experience, I would not have had the view of humanity that I now hold. So when you're talking about that experience, when I walk in the door, when you walk in the door, there would be a lot more commonality, I think, given our experiences, than people would assume. So that risk of assuming anything about people based upon walking in the door and seeing a skin tone or whatever the identifier is, how do we help people understand the importance of educating themselves so that they don't go by what they see, but engage in making sure that they can develop an opinion based upon what they come to know?
Well, and how they're trained, right? I mean, and it's not trained in an intentional way, but, you know, obviously there's all the talk around unintended bias, but, you know, how they cross the street when you see, you know, young African-American men in a group with dreads, ooh, you know, it's right. Like, wait a minute, you know, if you go back to about a week ago and Barack Obama was on CNN with his, you know, my brother's keeper, and meeting and reconnecting with the men that had kind of helped start that program that he created, you know, those were normal, you know, not normal, that's the wrong word. I hate the word normal, by the way.
I do.
Those were just, I will say, like, kind of run of the mill guys. And, right. And he said this great comment. He goes, I'm not looking for, you know, the cream of the crop, you know, 4.0 student. And I'm not looking for the most troubled. I want that he used the term run of the mill that you just run into. Now these guys had, a couple of them had dreads. They had different, I think it's when you say, you know what? But they had families, they had daughters, they care about what happens with the kids, they've got careers, they got dreams, they have aspirations. I think when you start relating to people on, and I think that's a very human level relative to kind of hopes, dreams, feelings, you get away from appearance. And I would say that beyond just people of color, you get into male, female, you get into, I'd say we've done a lot in our company around people with, you know, disabilities. We've got a lot of folks that on the autism spectrum or what have you, that work in our stores, and they're incredible people. I mean, unbelievably talented and skilled, and have what I call superpowers. And it's just, you've got to get to know them, but don't just judge a book by its cover. And they have hopes, they have dreams. They are very different than what yours and mine are, probably. And sometimes, given the person's station in life, the hope is, I just want to live on my own. Great. Lean into what people care about and dream about and hope about. And I think that conversation can open up doors. And I've just found, even though people may come from completely different experiences, you can often find, if you're willing to be vulnerable, that there's a connection at some level on either what the hopes are, what truth is, what is right, you know, and what is not right. So I think engaging at that level is critical.
Yeah. Now we're just, let me see, almost a year and a month past the George Floyd murder back in 2020. And, you know, one of the things that I decried when I saw a lot of it happening, and let me just say this in terms of reference, when we worked together at Anheuser-Busch, and this is one of the things I love about that experience, we had all the multiculturalism and targeting and all these types of things with people engaged to make sure they understood it long before it was cool. In many ways, I think the company set the model. But when the George Floyd, you know, incident happened, and of course the resulting activity, I was talking to PR Week about this, and there was this point about all of them now putting out the ads and doing this and that and what have you, and I called it bandwagoning, because I thought, oh yeah, they're on the bandwagon now. But the question is, matter of sustainability. Once the heat is off, once the eyes are turned to another issue, will this type of thing continue? And then later on, I spoke with Damon Jones of Procter & Gamble about the work that they've been doing, because much like Anheuser-Busch had done, they've been in it for years. So right now, there's a lot of interest, and people are using all the right terms and, you know, apparently asking all the right questions and apparently doing the right thing. Get back into that category of symbolism. What about sustainability? What about what it takes from a leadership perspective? You've run, you know, large companies, and the dictate as it relates to how the company is going to be in terms of its culture often comes from that level. How do you convince them? And I know that you've mentioned training, but beyond training, what about the topic of personal example? And the reason I am asking you that is because you're involved in so many different things with so many different groups of people. Some of them are based up on, you know, ethnicity and race. You're doing this because you're choosing to do this, and you've done this whether you were in business or not. So how do you take that mindset and drill it through the organization so that it becomes the expected set of behavior and values versus just doing it from a perspective of, we're going to take out the right ads, we're going to do the right placements, so on and so forth?
Right. No, that's a great question. I think one is modeling, and not modeling out of the, I'll step back. I think there's two words, which are convenience and change, and can be two C words. And convenience was sort of, to me, what a lot of organizations and people were doing, in your term, bandwagoning, sort of like, hey, you know, it's convenient now and I can do this. And I think you got to let it change you. And like I said, I'm fortunate, I believe, to have had the upbringing and experience I've had. Although honestly, it was then it became, you know, a little less diverse as I got into the business world, because that's, you know, going back to the 90s and the early 2000s, that's what it was. I had friends like Danny Scott, yourself. I mean, had people in the company, but not, as you know, few and far between a bit. even though I think we were trying to make a lot of the right decisions. You have to kind of allow yourself to be changed first. And I think allow yourself to have conversations with people. I can be the first to say that during Ferguson, I was frustrated with how our community was portrayed. And I was frustrated and initially blaming the people protesting or in the street, not everybody, but just the, and obviously there's always going to be, or can be bad actors amongst those situations. As I came to know people involved in that movement here, I came to understand the anger and the frustration. And then as you start watching things like 13th and Amend, and you start reading White Fragility and Cast and Broken Heart of America, which really chronicles St. Louis's history, and you have conversations with people in our company who are incredibly talented and incredibly educated, who have been told, don't let your hair go natural. You've got to keep it straight if you want to fit in. And all this just almost overwhelms you. And if it doesn't change you, kind of shame on you. But it's what serves as the energy around the behavior you want to model. And for me, it was through a lot of soul searching, because when I was in Anheuser-Busch, I was very involved in a lot of charitable stuff. I mean, as you know, because the company was.
Right.
And I started thinking, man, I'm spreading all this stuff and I'm not energized by it. It's taking energy versus giving energy. And the things that I decided I kind of cared about most were social justice and racial equity, and frankly, veterans issues, which in an odd way, politically can be in different spectrums. Mm-hmm. But in many respects to me, those were things that gave me energy. So I started pouring and this was a decision I made about 2 or 3 years ago. So mm-hmm. I started pouring my energy into it. I do think there's always the risk of, like you said, bandwagon. We're seeing it right now, right? I mean, it's Juneteenth, so becomes a federal holiday on Thursday. So I got my team saying, "Hey, should we do this? Send action plans out." I'm like, first, we're all short labor. Number one. Number two, the last thing I want to do is go send out a bunch of objectives to already stretched staff on Friday. And I said, what we should do is let them express the way they want, which they've done. And we do cookie cakes and stuff that's great. But then when you do that, so I've got a store just literally before this call where we've got some social media activity because they did something perceived inappropriate. And they thought they were doing the right thing, putting, you know, if helium balloons up, I think it was 1865, mm-hmm. and then, you know, selling some cookie cakes, but they had a cooler watermelon next to it. Very stereotypical and very offensive, believing they're doing the right thing.
Okay.
We got everybody, you know, coming at right, so sure. I would say we address that quickly. And that is the, what you have to allow for in the conversation and the training, and I call training, but the discussions you need to have. Now we've talked to that manager and those teammates literally 10 minutes before we got on, our operations group is doing that. And that's going to fuel the discussion. So I'm like, hey, this is a great opportunity now to bring some folks together from our stores with some other folks in our company who are leading the diversity and inclusion efforts to say, let's explain why that didn't make sense because they literally thought they're doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. And they do it from a place and a good intent. So you don't want to just come down on people for that, but you got to help them a little bit, mm-hmm. understand why maybe that's not the right approach.
Right.
Yeah, I think it's the C word change. People right. need to really allow themselves to be changed. Yeah. And it's work. That's why I made the comment on that post you referenced that there's still work to do. And the movement started well before slavery ended. And while there's been progress, it just gets to be a continued movement well beyond you and me.
Right. You have responsibility, obviously, for the success of the businesses you've led. So profit and loss is important, particularly in this almost post-pandemic world we're living in. When you're looking at these types of circumstances, and you know, I can personally tell you, Dave, that when I went to St. Louis University, I'd never met a person who was Catholic. And one day I was used to be the old mercantile bank there at Grand and Lindell. And Mary Brimmer, who was the dean of students, was walking out of the bank, and she had what appeared to me to be dirt on her forehead. And I went to wipe it off, and she just, no, don't do that. And I was like, but you have dirt on your head. And she says, no, Charles, she says, it's Ash Wednesday. And I asked her what it was. I'd never heard of it. It wasn't part of my, you know, faith upbringing. So she explained it to me, and I tell you that because there's this tendency in the world we live in now where people don't know what they don't know, yet speak out on it anyway, and that is problematic. But there are instances, of course, where people do know exactly what they're doing and pretend otherwise. But let's talk about that former case. As a person who's responsible for a business and has to make sure that you don't get in hot water with people over things that are really simple mistakes because of the cancel culture that we live in and the threats and attacks that businesses endure, how do you keep an eye on that without going too far to the extreme on one end of the spectrum, which is when mistakes are made, overreacting, and then when people do something that's really, really stupid and clearly understood in the context of what it is, not ignoring it to the extent that people think that you are not concerned with the issue at all?
Right. So it's another great question. I think for me, you know, I come probably from a place of faith, which there is only one judge, mm-hmm. and I'm not him. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think there's a lot of judgment that goes on in the world. And that's where the curiosity has to come in as to why. I think why do people behave the way they do? Why are they making the decisions they make? So in your case, perfectly innocent. You're like, oh, someone's got a smudge on their head. Right. They don't know it.
Right, you know? Exactly.
So, comes from a place, and you, if you assume, you know, if you come from curious, which is something we talk a lot about, and there's a culture in our company that we would like to promote, and you assume good intent. Now, there's not always good intent, but if you assume good intent and are curious, I think 99 times out of 100, you'll find that these things occur out of a lack of knowledge or a lack of sort of understanding from an empathetic point of view. And then when it's not, you know, and we have seen this, and we've had to take action with people before where there were highly discriminatory and we needed to take action on someone, like, look, it's just not tolerable. You just don't tolerate it. And that is something I think we've, as an organization at least, have become more and more clear about what we will not tolerate. Mm-hmm. But you've got to leave room, to your point, for wiping the smudge off the forehead without knowing, or, hey, I actually built this display next to a cooler that already had watermelons. It wasn't intentional, but now I get it. You know, it's just people sometimes are either lack of awareness, lack of sensitivity and empathy, but they're coming from a place of wanting to either understand or be supportive. Mm-hmm. So it's Pride Month and we're going through the same thing, you know, as I told, we've got an amazing leader in our organization who is openly gay, an amazing guy. And, you know, he said that for forever, I couldn't put a picture of me and my significant other on my desk. And I, you know, when I started, I said, you should put that on your desk. You should be unabashed. You should, you know, again, not be judged by anybody, mm-hmm. For that, for who you love and who loves you. So, but it's hard. I mean, like you said, we're human beings. So mm-hmm. we make mistakes. Some people come from a bad place, and yet at the same time, some amazing courage is demonstrated and amazing stories. And that's the part that gets me excited, is when you really get into understanding people's kind of journey through these situations, and being open to learning from that.
The challenge of being a leader of a major organization of great size is doing exactly what you've just described, is to be embracing of all. And in your leadership ranks, as you are looking at the people that you're bringing on to lead business functions or other functions accordingly, what type of vetting process, if I can call it that, would you say you hope to see that's applicable not only with the company that you lead right now, but any company, to really discern what people are trying to bring to the table? And the reason I ask that question, Dave, is, you know, the time to figure out whether someone's going to be part of your culture is during that assessment phase, right? When you're bringing them in, how do you get there without breaking the law, right? Because there are EEOC implications and everything. How do you ensure that you're just not hiring a horrible person who's literally going to be hiding in plain sight and, despite the company culture, comes in and wreaks havoc on what you're trying to build?
Yeah, I'd say for, you know, what I say leadership levels, we go through a company called Psychological Associates that does the mm-hmm. testing. And I think that testing needs to be modified to at least reveal mindsets and behaviors, which can, you know, we do it from a professional leadership standpoint. There's no reason we shouldn't do it as a piece of leadership as it relates to openness, empathy, vulnerability, et cetera. And I think the other thing, and because we've got 14,000 people in our company, you know, Anheuser-Busch had about 11,000 when I was there. Look, that's just so many people. You're going to have, you know, every spectrum of belief and point of view on things. And I think the one thing that most leaders regret, and including myself, like when you find someone or suspect there's a cultural gap, that you make a move on it quickly. It can be corrosive. There's a great leader named Kat Cole who used to run Focus Brands, a lot of restaurant experience. She's a good friend. And she tells the story very openly and vulnerably about growing up and having kind of issues with her father, and how her mother finally sort of ran him out of the house and felt a lot of remorse about it because, hey, I'm depriving my daughter of my father. Mm. And she says, you know, the first thing I said to mom was, what took so long? Hmm. And how Kat connects it to business is, you have people in your organization that can be corrosive, and when you let them go, if your teammates are saying, what took so long, mm-hmm. that should be telling. Mm-hmm. But I think it's a great example of how she does that in a very vulnerable and open way. Mm-hmm. And it's just, I can see your reaction when you hear it in that context. Wow. That's, I can feel that. And that's important. And so I do think leaders need to be very vulnerable and open about themselves and maybe their lived experience to get credibility for why they're doing things that they're doing within an organization.
Mm-hmm. The concept of, and I find it interesting, you know, because we love labels. So I say DE&I and everybody calls it that. I absolutely abhor labels, much like you do. But since that's what we're stuck with is what we're stuck with. There's a tendency, much as it is reflected across the nation throughout the world, that there are favorite, you know, DE&I categories that everybody focuses on. You know, when people get into the discussion, the conversation goes to black and white, I'm thinking about, well, what about every other person? How do you ensure there's a clarion call to make sure that when we're talking about inclusion, equity, and diversity, that we're really being embracing of all of it? Because it's so much more broad than we tend to think about. I actually was speaking with someone the other day, and I said that I find it interesting that people think that when you're speaking of it, that means that you are speaking for everyone, based up on the selection of someone who allegedly represents that point of view. So how do you make it more inclusive, diverse, and equitable by making sure that the voices represented are not limited?
And I think we talked about it earlier, but you know, I love the fact, and I can say, like, having had some experience personally with sort of the spectrum, you know, and in our family, and understanding, I mean, I've had my own issues with anxiety. Mm. So we've had a whole mental health chapter, if you will, in our discussions and efforts and what we call, you know, courageous conversations, because we have these within our group. And what it's done, and these used to be 20, 30 people, now they're over 80. Wow. And most of them just listening to learn and understand. And I think that's really important. And, you know, we can all relate with, I think when you hear a mother tell a story, like happened a couple of days ago on one of our courageous conversations, that brought me to tears, of the challenge her son had coming out, who's fine now, you know, he's gone through that, but the torment, torture, because there's these norms, if you will, and no matter what, it's 12 years old, 13, whatever, whenever, you're struggling with that. Okay, I'm different. And while, you know, that should be celebrated, and there, by the way, are many others like you, it's just such a personal internal battle. That movie Love, Simon, I thought was really, really apropos and good for kids to understand a little bit, because obviously the visual video medium is something that's really important for people, I think, sometimes for understanding things. But it's being open and really understanding where people are come from. And, you know, I say we're all kind of walking around as glass houses, right? I mean, because we're human beings, that's we're right. Not perfect. We have our stuff. I always say you can drive by these neighborhoods, especially where I live, and everybody thinks everything's idyllic and perfect. And like, no, there is torment and torture in every house you drive by. Mm-hmm. And so, in varying degrees, and it's as long as you kind of come into things knowing that, and then be open to people, again, people's lived experience, and making sure people feel like they're safe to share that. And I think that's the thing I'm most impressed with our team is, for the most part, I mean, it's not universal. I'm sure we have 111 stores, so it could be different in different places, but with what I've seen and experienced is people feel pretty safe sharing some of their stories, and it will get quite emotional. And that's when you get real impact. And I think that's when you really change perspectives pretty quickly.
Yeah. Dave, when you're talking about these things, it becomes clear to me that this does go to the core. You mentioned faith earlier in our conversation, and that faith obviously, you know, courses throughout everything that you're doing. And as you're looking at the distinct differences now between what is considered success, you were talking about the neighborhood and every place that you go, somebody's going through something that you wouldn't necessarily understand. But the trappings of perceived success versus the reality of people living lives that are different than we may imagine certainly has to funnel into that daily engagement with the people who work at your company, whether they're higher on the fee chain or not, right? So that story, as you are now telling it, makes me wonder, you're leading a very broad, very diverse organization. I used to shop at Schnucks all the time. Okay, so I'm not just saying that because you're on. But how do you make sure that the people who are, you're doing that internally with the people who work for the company, but how do you make sure that that's understood by the people who are coming to the stores? Who are,
and that's the challenge.
Yeah, shopping and being a part, because it's an extension of the culture, right? So when I go into a Schnucks store, I mean, outside of the incident you just mentioned you dealt with today, you're engaging with people one-on-one, and those associates, those people that are there, are a reflection of your brand, obviously. So how do I, customer number one, walk in and know, you know, this place gets it? And you said that's a challenge. So please speak about that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we did with we did have this Unity is Power T-shirts that in taking a stand against racism that was a lot in type on the back. So we made a very public and visible statement as a company. And I give a lot of credit to the family who owns it all the way down to do that. Came with a lot of challenge because lots of negative, you know, from people that don't want to see that, or you're being political, or they think it's, oh, that's a Democrat point of view. Say, no, that's a human point of view. Yet at the same time, people who just praised it and loved it. And so you've got this polarizing situation from a customer standpoint, difficult on teammates because, as you know, hey, there's three of us out of 80 working in the store wearing the shirt. What about the other 77? You know, what does that say? And so it was a risk, but it spurred conversation, which I think was important. And again, it's no utopia by any means. We serve 1.5 to 1.7 million people a week, and they come from all walks of life. And you know, I've talked to folks in stores and parts of our rural geography that, you know, feel like the vaccine has a chip in it, and you know, have points of view relative to that, all the way to the people who have a completely opposite point of view on things. And it's frankly listening and being understanding and open to both. Number one, it's also recognizing, look, most people are coming in here because they want to buy 10 to 15 things and get out fast and be treated with respect. And so that's the one thing we say is, look, you treat everyone with respect. Make sure and recognize everybody should have dignity. You're going to run into customers that say things and do things. Believe me when I say I've been tempted hearing stories to, expunge certain customers from our business. But I think where and I've heard from teammates now, as we've had these discussions more and more, it's giving them strength, and it's the tightness and the tight-knit nature of the team that helps them get through those situations. That I think, prior to a more open dialogue and open experience may not have existed before. And so they felt more isolated and, I'm going through this experience, I can't really talk about it, and maybe it's just me. And now they understand, no, it's not just me, and I can talk about it, and I can feel better about it.
There's an intersectionality, clearly, from the business perspective to the more social community-based one. It seems that you are in many ways making sure that there is this engagement that happens almost by default, by on the one hand being on the business side of things, but then being on the social side of things, so that you can engage with various peoples, various entities, various perspectives. I'm from St. Louis. That's not necessarily the norm. So since it isn't, do you consider, and I know that you are modest, so I'm saying this, audience, he's not. Do you consider yourself somewhat visionary in approaching things the way you've described here, so that perhaps others might emulate those activities and behaviors? Or are you simply doing what you believe is appropriate because it is appropriate, and let the chips fall where they may?
It's the latter. I don't think, look, I'm by no means perfect. And I'm, you know, I have, again, one lived experience and a point of view, and I'm open to other points of view, open to learning, open to change, and very willing to be vulnerable. But I do see others in this community, and some close friends that have been great role models for me. You know, Rich McClure, who left Unigroup to co-chair the Ferguson Commission, is a very good friend. And that, and walking that with him a little bit was profoundly changing for him. You know, Penny Pennington is someone who's come in to run Edward Jones and has a vision and a view on what that organization can be and do and represent. Suzanne Sitherwood at Spire, who comes from Atlanta. And frankly, it, when she started, we met 5 months for the first time for lunch before Michael Brown. And I remember at lunch getting to know her, love, you know, I'm a curious person, asking her questions, and said, so what do you see is the biggest challenge in St. Louis? And Mark, this is 5 months before Michael Brown. She's like, you all have a race problem. You don't talk about it. Well, we talk about it now. And, you know, I think all the events in the last 7 years, you know, in this market, it's not just, you know, George Floyd has led to that dialogue. And, you know, it is actually encouraging. And a great example is Tashar Jones, who's our mayor. You know, she is someone who I would say 5-6 years ago, I was, you know, oh my gosh, if she were mayor, I don't know. And not because she was a black woman, but because, you know, she had what I felt were pretty radical ideas. And as I've come to both know her, I'm sure as she has come to change, as she has talked to more people, because she's a very curious person, that then converged into supporting her for that role and getting to know her and calling her a friend and, you know, telling her anytime she needs something, let me know. Because, you know, while we may have different points of view on how we get there, she cares deeply about the region, as do I. And so, you know, and more our points of view are very similar, and where they're not, we can talk about it, and that's fine. And I love being able to have that open dialogue, and she's in the position to actually make the change, which is great. So, no, I don't, I think it's great to see the region starting to open up. It's got a lot of work to do, and there's still some, you know, kind of vagaries of the past that are hanging around as far as either organizations or just dynamics, but it is starting to change, which is great.
You are obviously engaged in a lot of civic organizations, and, you know, are there different protocols for dealing with ones that perhaps were not as focused on DEI issues? And then, of course, the community-based organizations, which are focused on individual aspects of the community, whether they be Black, Latino, LGBTQ+, et cetera, to make sure that those voices are incorporated into those other organizations who may not be so inclined to be exposed to hearing what those other organizations have to say.
There are. So what I'd say has happened is we've been a region defined by fragmentation. For your audience, you know, we've got a separate city county. We've got 90-ish municipalities within the county. We've got more elected officials when you count municipal officials, municipal mayors, et cetera, than the federal government by almost 100. So against that, and you've got a river dividing two states. So you've got, but in that backdrop, or with that backdrop, we also had, you know, numerous organizations and business groups and, you know, redundancy in that area, where at least at the business level, you've seen that now come together. Led by Jason Hall, who is an openly gay man, which is phenomenal. And just that, you know, in a city now who is run by its first Black female mayor. I mean, so you are starting to see the change, and the openness, and that's encouraging. And I think the other thing you're starting to see is, I would say, finally acceptance of, but I'd say some of the activists that were very involved in Ferguson, who have started organizations like Dream Builders or We Power, like Charlie Cooksey's done, get connected into that group and be taken seriously for what they're doing. And I think the unifying piece being, look, we all care about this region. You know, we want to see this is a, and you know, this place, you grew up here. Mm-hmm. There's amazing, great things about it, but it's highly underconfident. It's got a chip on its shoulder. Mm-hmm. It's got some, you know, challenged history. But as I always say, it's about what we do going forward, not what's happened in the back. We need to have that as a reference and understand the context, but then we've got to make the right decisions going forward. And you're starting to see signs of that, which is encouraging. And I always, being an idealist, the glass half full guys, think this could actually be, go from the broken heart of America to the showplace of how to do it right and how to recover. But there's a lot of work to do. We're still heinously divided, not to mention socioeconomically with the Del Mar divide, which has been written about in some major newspapers, and how that division needs to go away somehow.
Mm-hmm. You know, the thing that really stands out to me, and I'm going to be interested in this, I think I have a general idea of how you'll respond, but I still want to hear it in your words. You know, when you finished up your time at Anheuser-Busch and you started engaging in other business avenues, I mean, you're a smart guy. You have a lot of skill and ability. It's not perfunctory flattery. It's my opinion. You could have done anything, anywhere, yet you stayed in St. Louis. I'd like to know why.
You know, it's a combination. I think part of it's, again, your lived experience. I grew up in the same house and in Webster Groves, Missouri, you know, my whole life. And that was, so I got to go to grade school through high school with the same group of friends. And my wife, who's from DC area, had a similar experience. Grew up in the same house pretty much. And I think, And you know, went to school with a group of folks and had friends and what have you. And that was important and forming for us. It doesn't mean, you know, if you're in, you know, what they call them, an army brat, and you had to move around or what, that isn't good too. I know a lot of people who've had that experience, but that was our experience. And when I left, you know, our kids were in middle school, and that's a tough time. I don't know. I want to see the person that says, man, my best years were middle school. I've never met them. But, you know, we made the decision that, you know, we want to finish out their growth here. Mm-hmm. And let them kind of have that experience. And I think we're thankful for it. It could have gone to Europe or somewhere and worked internationally, as you said, but that just wasn't. And I know people who've done that and have had amazing experiences. That just wasn't what we wanted. And I had a passion for the region as well. And felt, you know, I can take the experience I had and some of the relationships and connections to try to make a little bit of a difference. So that, I think that combination kept us here and you know, remain here today.
And you're making a lot of, you know, effort to help, I'll call it what it is. It's the reputation of the area. Now, I can tell you, I've done a lot of fighting because, and I don't know if you remember this from previous talks, but I worked for the City of St. Louis Police Department for several years, and I know all the good stuff about what goes into that. So when it gets to debates about, you know, things involving law enforcement and, you know, African-Americans, I always am pretty much able to make the argument that everywhere you go, in every capacity that you will exist, there will be people who are great people doing something, and there will be some horrible people who are doing that same thing. But you can't judge everybody by those who are doing the horrible thing. As it is in St. Louis, at that time when I was with the department, at those couple of years, it was the murder capital of the nation. I think it's been a couple of times since I left. But that's not to say that there aren't great things still happening there. It is a place that you are trying to help people actually feel comfortable in making home, in visiting, all because of those things that are in place. How do you, given all of the experience, the business acumen, the personal perspective, the interest in solidifying a vision that shows St. Louis growing into what it can be versus being stuck in the muck of what it was, how do you take all of that and roll it out across the nation so that people know about St. Louis what you know about St. Louis right now?
I think part of it is also being comfortable or recognizing some people are going to leave, right? I mean, there's some great people here. Starsky Wilson, well, yourself, right?
Yeah, I mean, right.
Yeah, exactly. You, Starsky Wilson, who's running the Children's Defense Fund, who was co-chair of the Ferguson Commission, worked for the Deaconess Foundation when he was here. Brittany Packnett, who's made a name for herself, especially with education, ran Teach for America here for a while, but several other endeavors. And they are making a good name for St. Louis as they, have gone out into other places. And then I think it's the intention, and especially with this business group coming together to say, we need to, reimagine and reform what the perspective of St. Louis is. And I don't think, and I totally agree, because one time I thought, well, if you just merge the city and the county, your murder stats look better. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that's just diluting the math. Mm-hmm. We still have a problem.
Right, exactly.
Because if you get even more microscopic in the places like Walnut Park and Penrose, those are some of the most dangerous places in the world, mm-hmm. not just the country. Mm-hmm. So those need to be addressed and dealt with. I've got a very close friend of mine who you probably know, Erica Van Ross, who is head of communications mm-hmm. at the police department, mm-hmm. Maybe before or after your time. And mm-hmm. then another woman who works with us, whose husband is, I don't know if he's a captain or not. Let's call him in leadership at the police department. Okay. She's African-American. Mm-hmm. And her son, mm-hmm. who works for the police department mm-hmm. in St. Louis City. And so she's had to live the reality of them being yelled at, them having to work the long shifts during protests, mm-hmm. and yet them having a lived Black experience mm-hmm. in St. Louis. Mm-hmm. And she's been a phenomenal person for me to spend time with and mm-hmm. sit down, listen, and talk to. And we'll sit in her office sometimes for 2 hours mm-hmm. and just, I'll listen because I can soak it up. Mm-hmm. And to your point, it's challenging. But like you said, labeling and judging, those are the two things that, are somewhat at the heart of labeling, judging, and a lack of vulnerable communication probably are what keep us divided mm-hmm. versus saying, look, we're all human beings and let's be vulnerable and open with each other and recognize that we have similar hopes and dreams at some level. And then that's a place where we can start from.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You've talked a lot about the things that you now know that you're applying in terms of how you're running business, how you are working within the community. But if I were to ask you, Dave, for a business leader who is just beginning the journey to actually try to put in place DEI practices, approaches, culture, what's the one thing that you didn't know that you would learn that you would share with them that would help them now?
How much people are carrying with them that if you don't, and it's a difficult challenge to read who's going to be open in a forum, 20 people, whatever, and who needs a one-on-one discussion, and then devote the time to those one-on-one discussions. I've had hours and hours of interactions and dialogue with folks that brought me to tears. And it is through that, because of that, in that environment, people are more vulnerable, that you come to understand some of the issues and you build an empathy and reinforce a vulnerability as a leader that you need to show to model to other leaders in the organization, so that in a store they can have that same conversation with a teammate that I may never know. Mm-hmm. And I've had teammates come up to me and say, I just love manager X because we sat and we talked for an hour and a half and she told me this and this, and I told her this, and we were crying at the end. I'm like, that's great. Because that teammate was more connected and will serve as an ambassador for our organization and our culture. But it's devoting that time mm-hmm. and making it a priority. Mm-hmm. But it's great because it's just having human interaction and discussion with people. Mm-hmm. And I think post pandemic of living on Zoom, mm-hmm. it's better now than ever to lean into those conversations.
This is interesting to me. A couple of podcasts ago, I had a woman I know who is a women's health advocate, Ellen, and I, you know, mixed it up a little bit, and I asked her the question. I said, for men who are trying to support women, what's the one thing that they can do? And I don't know, maybe I was expecting some, you know, longer explanation, but she had a single word. She said, listen. And as I'm thinking about her reaction to that question, I'm listening to you. If I were asking you the same question, you're saying pay attention and care to the people that you work with. Is that fair?
I think it's fair. I think it's fair. And it's, we all get busy and we can all get distracted. And there's certainly times once you've built those relationships, you know, you still need to get things done. Mm-hmm. But everybody's, I think if done right, you're managing, you're bringing your whole self to work. Mm-hmm. and you're managing from a place of trust. Mm-hmm. And that's when you build trust. Mm-hmm. And that's how you build it. And I do think the listening is critical. I mean, and you know, I think most, this is going to be judging and labeling, but most guys probably don't listen the way we should. And we all, you know, I know I fall into the trap of needing to be better at it. I think sponsorship's important too. And I say that more than mentorship. I'm a big believer in sponsorship over mentorship. Mentorship is sort of this ethereal concept that I can't relate to for some reason, but sponsorship of, no, I'm not just going to, you know, help you with quote unquote advice, but I'm going to sponsor and make sure things happen for you. Mm-hmm. That is one thing too, that I've been very passionate around is sponsoring people. Our head of sales or our head of operations is a woman for the first time in the history of the company. And I met her when she was a division manager in Rockford, and she was highly regarded by everybody, but I was like blown away. And I'm a new guy, new to the grocery industry, and just loved her passion, her approach. She treats everybody consistently, you know, and, you know, we put her on a path for this role. Mm-hmm. And she has been way exceeded expectations. She has been phenomenal. Mm-hmm. And she's an example of someone who I and others have sponsored. And I think that sponsorship piece is really, really critical.
Mm-hmm. So you are literally speaking about a different type of president, CEO, chief operating officer, all the different types. You've got them all. But you're actually speaking about a different, you know, perspective than both you and I are probably used to, given the companies that we've come up in, where, you know, there's usually this kind of person at the top who's disconnected from all of it. But you're actually saying that that shouldn't be the case. And not only as it relates to diversity, equity, and inclusion, but just in terms of building a culture, how important do you see that in driving the way business is going to operate within America now, if people take on the mantle of assuming that level of responsibility? Now, we've seen it a little bit, obviously, with certain companies, but how do we actually, and I love what you said about, you know, given the pandemic experience, it's not necessarily being a kinder, gentler company, but just being a company led by an individual or individuals who get the fact that everybody needs to feel like they're part of something and demonstrating that in very active ways.
Yeah, I think that's just it. I think everybody wants to be a part of something with purpose or movement and mission. And so, you know, it's behaving and understanding and connecting with that. And there's a great book that's just out called, I think they call it The Heart of Business by you, and I'm going to mispronounce it, Hubert Joly, who ran Best Buy and helped bring that business back by bringing kind of purpose to that organization. But I think you're right. I mean, people, and especially, you know, call it millennial/Gen Z, whatever it is, they're more purpose driven. And I do think it's important that leaders get, you know, I call it truth tellers. I want truth tellers in the organization at all levels. And they're hard to find, because I remember this quote from Fred Smith, who founded FedEx, still runs it today, said, the first day you become called in charge is the last day you hear the truth. Mm. And so finding truth tellers to tell you what's really happening is invaluable to an organization. Mm. And not just on diversity efforts, but everything, you know, how we're not doing something right, or how we are not hiring, or we're not training or onboarding properly, et cetera, et cetera. So, I think that's really critical for leaders is to understand those dynamics within the organization. Mm-hmm.
Speaking of that perspective, when are you going to write your book? Because that's a book I'd read.
You know, I've never been motivated to do that. I just, I mean, this is great to have the conversation with you. I just, it's funny because I'm a journalism major. So, oh, you're a writer. But I kind of come from a place like, who am I to write it? And, you know, because I think I just kind of come from that perspective. You never know down the road, but yeah, I do write notes to our team. A little less regularity now that are very kind of heartfelt and, you know, specific. But yeah, I just know I've never, and I feel like also things are unfinished. You know, that implies a finishedness. I'll make up a word, you know, that oh, this is done. And it's like, it's not, it's continued. It's
okay.
And so carving out a piece of a journey seems off to me, because I feel like a book has to have a beginning and an end.
Yeah, well, we're going to dispossess you of that. I'm going to put just the teeniest bit of pressure on you by reminding you of something that the late Dr. Maya Angelou said, which is, when you learn, teach, and you've learned plenty, now it's time for you to continue teaching that. And I'm not saying that to just blow air up your pant leg. Speaking about truth tellers, you know, usually in the earlier age of this, Dave, they called folks like us, you know, shit disturbers. So now we get truth tellers, which I am very much more comfortable with. But I think that, you know, whether it's this podcast or anything, the ability for people to get a perspective beyond their own limited understanding from the, you know, through the eyes of someone who's done what you've done, gone through what you've gone through, and has this innate sense of faith about why they're on this journey. It doesn't have to be finished as much as it has to be inspiring and aspirational. So I'm going to just push back the teeniest little bit and say, oh, you've got plenty to say, because if you did, not tell you. But that's just the thing. And I do think that even in this conversation, there are going to be a lot of people who are picking up on nuggets they never thought of before. And that's what you do with what you write. I know you've got limited time and all of that, but I just think that in moving the world forward a little bit, just like those books you referenced, they may have had similar thoughts. You've got more to say than perhaps you even know. So I would encourage you to consider that just a little bit.
Well, I appreciate it. That's that does frame things differently for me. So no, again, it's, you get different perspectives, which always helps.
Yeah, and you definitely have different perspectives. Dave, I want to thank you for spending time with me today, because as I said, I know that you're busy. You probably have more stores calling right now in this hour. But I want to also let people know that when you're looking for leaders who are into it for the right reasons, the things that they've heard you say today are certainly part of that understanding. And I want to encourage you to continue doing it. I know it's not been easy. I'm sure your skin is a lot thicker than it was 20 years plus ago. But you realize that the fight is won by people who continue doing it, and not the people who think that, to your point, it simply has an end. Thank you for not ending the fight and continuing to fight for what makes sense and is practical for us all. So I appreciate that.
Well, I appreciate it. And like I say, there's, you think you're doing it right, and then you learn, you know, every week, every month, every day. And that informs sort of even how you change. And, you know, I appreciate you having these kind of podcasts. These are really important conversations to be had. I'm a big podcast fan, because I think it's a great medium for more in-depth versus soundbite versus 140 characters. I mean, our world is sort of filled with that. If you look at the amount of media as a journalism major who is concerned about journalism and where it's going,
right,
I think these types of formats are fantastic.
Right. Yeah. Well, thank you. And given all of that, other than the work that you've got going on, anything else new and exciting on the horizon for Dave Peacock?
No, things are good. You know, I've got kids that are moving off to college, and
I can't,
you
know, even believe that.
Life is a constant transition. So I think it's getting comfortable with that, and realizing there's a new chapter where they're, you know, adults and doing their thing. And that's going to be fun to watch.
Can you even believe that? That you've got kids who are going off to college. Can you believe it?
I got one that'll be out next year.
What?
So, I mean, you believe that? Yeah. It's crazy. I know.
When did
you and I were together, it was like, yeah, we were little people.
When did we get to be this age? I don't know.
Something weird. I know. I believe me. I say that. I've got a trainer who's 31, she was complaining today about this and that. And I'm like, look, you're 22 years younger than me. So don't even start.
Perspective is everything.
Right.
All right. Well, thanks again, Dave, for all of your time again. And keep doing the good work and doing the good fight. And you and I are, of course, going to stay in touch, because even when you don't know it, I'm watching and listening and learning from you. You keep doing it.
Well, and you too. Hey, you too. And the fact that you're putting yourself out there and doing things like this is important. So we appreciate it. And you're a shining star from St. Louis who's reflecting well on your hometown.
Well, thank you. My head's already big, but you just blew it up. So there we go. Have a good rest of your weekend.
All right. You too.
Take care.